for a moment, to get breath and courage both. I walk up to the door as boldly as I can. The knocker on the door is a piercing through the nose of a sinister carved face. I lift my hand to touch the ring, and the carving's eyes open.
"I remember you," says the door.
"My prince's lady."
"You're mistaken," I say.
"Seldom."
The door swings open with a slight creak that indicates disuse.
"Hail and welcome."
Hollow Hall is empty of servants and guards. No doubt it is difficult for Prince Balekin to cousin any of the folk to serve him when he is so clearly a creature of the undersea. And with the new rules card in passed, Balekin's ability to trick mortals into endless servitude has also been curtailed. I walk through echoing rooms to a parlor, where Balekin is drinking wine, surrounded by a dozen thick pillar candles. Above his head, red moths dance. He left them behind in the undersea, but now that he's back, they circle around him like a candle flame.
"Did anyone see you?"
he asks. "I don't believe so," I say with a curtsy. He stands, going to a long trestle table and lifting a small blown glass vial.
"I don't suppose you managed to murder my brother?"
"Madoc has ordered me away from the palace," I say. "I think he fears my influence over the High King. But I can do nothing to Cardin if I am not allowed to see him." Balekin takes another sip of his wine and walks to me.
"There's to be a ball. A masquerade to honor one of the lower court lords. It will be tomorrow. And so long as you are able to steal away from Madoc, I will find a way to get you in. Can you acquire a costume and mask yourself? Or will you need that from me as well?"
"I can costume myself," I say.
"Good."
He holds up the vial.
"Stabbing would be very dramatic at such a public function. Poison is ever so much easier. I want you to carry this with you until you have a moment alone with him. And then you must add it to his wine in secret."
"I will," I vow. Then he takes my chin, glamour in his voice.
"Tell me that you're mine, Jude."
When he places the vial in my hand, my fingers close over it. "I am your creature, Prince Balekin," I say, looking into his eyes and lying with my whole broken heart. "Do with me what you will. I am yours." Chapter 26. As I am about to leave Hollow Hall, I am suddenly beset by a wave of exhaustion. I sit down on the steps, lightheaded, and wait until the feeling passes. A plan is growing in my mind, a plan that requires the cover of dark, and my being well-rested, and reasonably well-equipped. I could go to Terran's house, but Locke would be there, and he did try to kill me that one time. I could return to Madoc, but if I do, it's likely that the servants have been instructed to roll me up in fuzzy blankets and hold me in cushioned captivity until Cardin is no longer under my command, but sworn to obey his Grand General. Horrifyingly, I wonder if the best thing to do is to stay here. There are no servants, no one to bother me but Balekin, and he is preoccupied. I doubt he would even notice my presence in this enormous and echoing house. I mean to be practical, but it's hard to fight against the instinct to run as far and as fast from Balekin as I can. But I've exhausted myself already. Having snuck through Hollow Hall enough times before, I know the way to the kitchens. I drink more water from the pump just beyond it, finding myself desperately thirsty. Then I wend my way up the steps to where Cardin once slept. The walls are as bare as I remember. The half-tester bed dominates the room with its carvings of dancing, bare-breasted catgirls. He had books and papers, now gone, but the closet is still full of extravagant and abandoned clothes. I suppose they are no longer ridiculous enough for the High King, but more than a few are black as night, and there's hose that will be easy to move in. I crawl into Cardin's bed, and although I fear I will toss and turn with nerves, I surprise myself by slipping immediately into a deep and dreamless sleep. Upon waking in the moonlight, I go to his closet and dress myself in the simplest of his clothes, a velvet doublet whose collar and cuffs I rip pearls from, along with a pair of plain soft leggings. I set out again, feeling less wobbly. When I pass through the kitchens, I find little in the way of food, but there's a corner of hard bread that I gnaw on as I walk through the dark. The Palace of Elfheim is a massive mound with most of the important chambers, including the enormous throne room, underground. At the peak is a tree, its roots worming down more deeply than could come from anything but magic. Just beneath the tree, however, are the few rooms that have panes of thin crystal letting in light. They are unfashionable rooms, like the one Cardin once set fire to the floor of, and where Nikasia popped out of his wardrobe to shoot him. That room is now sealed, the double doors locked and barred so that the passage to the royal chambers cannot be accessed. It would be impossible to get inside from within the palace. But I am going to climb the hill. Quietly, stealthily, I set off, sinking my two knives into the dirt, pulling myself up, wedging my feet on rocks and roots, and then doing it again. Higher and higher I go. I see bats circling overhead and freeze, willing them not to be anyone's eyes. An owl calls from a nearby tree, and I realize how many things could be observing me. All I can do is go faster. I am nearly to the first set of windows when weakness hits me. I grit my teeth and try to ignore the shaking of my hands, the unsteadiness of my step. I am breathing too fast, and all I want to do is give myself a rest. I am sure, though, that if I do, my muscles will stiffen up, and I won't be able to start again. I keep going, although my whole body hurts. Then I stab one of the knives into the dirt and try to lever myself up, but my arm is too weak. I can't do it. I stare down the steep, rocky hill, at the twinkling lights around the entrance to the Buddha. But for a moment, my vision blurs, and I wonder what would happen if I just let go. Which is a stupid thought. What would happen is that I would roll down the hill, hit my head, and hurt myself really badly. I hold on, scrabbling my way toward the glass panes. I have looked at the maps of the palace enough times that I only have to peer into three panes before I find the correct one. It looks down on only darkness, but I get to work, chipping at the crystal with my knife until it cracks. I wrap my hands in the sleeve of my doublet and break off pieces of it. Then I drop through it into the darkness of the rooms that Cardin abandoned. The walls and furnishings still stink of smoke and sour wine. I make my way by touch to the wardrobe. From there, it is easy to open the passage and pad down the hall, down the spiraling path to the royal chamber. I slip into Cardin's room. Though it is not yet dawn, I am lucky. The room is empty of revelry. No courtiers doze on the cushions or in his bed. I walk to where he sleeps and press my hand over his mouth. He wakes, fighting against my grip. I press down hard enough that I can feel his teeth against my skin. He grabs for my throat, and for a moment, I am scared that I am not strong enough, that my training isn't good enough. Then his body relaxes utterly, as though realizing who I am. He shouldn't relax like that. He sent me to kill you, I whisper against his ear. A shiver goes through his body, and his hand goes to my waist. But instead of pushing me away, he pulls me into bed with him, rolling my body across him onto the heavily embroidered coverlets. My hand slips from his mouth, and I am unnerved to find myself here, in the new High King's new bed, when I am still too human to lie in, beside someone who terrifies me the more I feel for him. Baelkin and Orla are planning your murder, I say, flustered.
Yes,
he says lazily.
So why did I wake up at all?
I am awkwardly conscious of his physicality, of the moment when he was half awake and pulled me against him. Because I am difficult to charm, I say. That makes him give a soft laugh. He reaches out and touches my hair, traces the hollow of my cheekbone.
I could have told my brother that,
he says, with a softness in his voice I am utterly unprepared for. If you hadn't allowed Matic to bar me from seeing you, I might have told you all this sooner. I have information that cannot wait. Cardin shakes his head.
I know not of what you speak. Matic told me that you were resting, and that we should let you heal.
I frown. I see. And in the interim, Matic would no doubt take my place as your advisor, I tell Cardin. He gave your guards orders to keep me out of the palace.
I will give them different orders,
Cardin says. He sits up in the bed. He's bare to the waist, his skin silvery in the soft glow of the magical lights. He continues looking at me in this strange way, as though he's never seen me before, or as though he thought he might never see me again. Cardin, I say, his name tasting strange on my tongue. A representative from the Court of Termites came to see me. She told me something.
What they asked in exchange for you,
he says.
I know all the things you will say. That it was foolish to agree to pay their price. That it destabilizes my rule. That it was a test of my vulnerabilities. And that I failed it. Even Matic believed it was a betrayal of my obligations. Although his alternatives weren't exactly diplomatic either. But you do not know Baelkin and Nikasia as I do. Better they think you are important to me than to believe what they do to you is without consequences.
I consider how they treated me when they believed me to be valuable, and shudder.
I have thought and thought since you were gone, and there is something I wish to say.
Cardin's face is serious, almost grave, in a way that he seldom allows himself to be.
When my father sent me away, at first I tried to prove that I was nothing like he thought me, but when that didn't work, I tried to be exactly what he believed I was instead. If he thought I was bad, I would be worse. If he thought I was cruel, I would be horrifying. I would live down to his every expectation. If I couldn't have his favor, then I would have his wrath. Baelkin did not know what to do with me. He made me attend his debauches, made me serve wine and food to show off his tame little prince. When I grew older and more ill-tempered, he grew to like having someone to discipline. His disappointments were my lashings. His insecurities, my flaws. And yet, he was the first person who saw something in me he liked. Himself. He encouraged all my cruelty, inflamed all my rage, and I got worse. I wasn't kind, Jude. Not to many people. Not to you. I wasn't sure if I wanted you, or if I wanted you gone from my sight so that I would stop feeling as I did, which made me even more unkind. But when you were gone, truly gone, beneath the waves, I hated myself as I never have before.
I am so surprised by his words that I keep trying to find the trick in them. He can't truly mean what he's saying.
Perhaps I am foolish, but I am not a fool. You like something about me,
he says, mischief lighting his face, making its planes more familiar.
The challenge? My pretty eyes? No matter, because there is more you do not like, and I know it. I can't trust you. Still, when you were gone, I had to make a great many decisions, and so much of what I did right was imagining you beside me, Jude, giving me a bunch of ridiculous orders that I nonetheless obeyed.
I am robbed of speech. He laughs, his warm hand going to my shoulder.
Either I've surprised you, or you are as ill as Maddock claimed.
But before I can say anything, before I can even figure out what I might say, a crossbow is suddenly lowered at me. Behind it stands the roach, with the bomb at his heels, twin daggers in her hands.
Your Majesty, we tracked her. She came from your brother's house.
And she's here to kill you. Please step out of the bed, says the bomb. That's ridiculous, I say.
If that's true, show me what charms you're wearing, says the roach. Rowan, is there even salt in your pockets? Because the Jude I know wouldn't go around with nothing.
My pockets are empty, of course, since Balekin would check for anything, and I don't need it anyway. But it doesn't leave me a lot of options in terms of proof. I could tell them about the Gesh from Dane, but they have no reason to believe me.
Please get out of the bed, Your Majesty, repeats the bomb.
I should be the one to get out. It's not my bed, I say, moving toward the footboard.
Stay where you are, Jude,
says the roach. Cardin slips out of the sheets. He's naked, which is briefly shocking, but he goes and pulls on a heavily embroidered dressing gown with no apparent shame. His lightly furred tail twitches back and forth in annoyance.
She woke me, he says. If she was intent on murder, that's hardly the way to go about it.
Empty your pockets,
the roach tells me.
Let's see your weapons. Put everything on the bed.
Cardin settles himself in a chair, his dressing gown enfolding him like a robe of state. I have little, the heel of bread, gnawed but unfinished, two knives, crusted with dirt and grass, and the stoppered vial. The bomb lifts it up and looks at me, shaking her head.
Here we go. Where did you get this?
From Balekin, I say, exasperated. Who tried to glamour me to murder Cardin because he needs him dead to persuade Grimson to make him his own crown of Elfheim. And that is what I came to tell the High King. I would have told you first, but I couldn't get to the Court of Shadows. The bomb and the roach share a disbelieving look. If I was really glamoured, would I have told you any of that?
Probably not, says the bomb. But it would make for quite a clever piece of misdirection.
I can't be glamoured, I admit. It's part of a bargain I made with Prince Dane, in exchange for my service as a spy. The roach's eyebrows go up. Cardin gives me a sharp look, as though sure that anything to do with Dane can't be good. Or perhaps he's just surprised that I have yet another secret.
I wondered what he gave you to make you throw in your lot with us ne'er-do-wells, the bomb says.
Mostly, a purpose, I say. But also the ability to resist glamour.
You could still be lying, says the roach.
He turns to Cardin.
Try her.
Your pardon?
Cardin says, drawing himself up. And the roach seems to suddenly remember to whom he's speaking in such an offhanded way.
Don't be such a prickly rose, Your Majesty,
the roach says with a shrug and a grin.
I'm not giving you an order. I'm suggesting that if you try to glamour Jude, we could find out the truth.
Cardin sighs and walks toward me. I know this is necessary. I know that he doesn't intend to hurt me. I know he can't glamour me. And yet, I draw back automatically.
Jude,
he asks. Go ahead, I say. I hear the glamour enter his voice, heady and seductive, and more powerful than I expected.
Crawl to me,
he says with a grin. Embarrassment pinks my cheeks. I stay where I am, looking at all their faces.
Satisfied?
The bomb nods.
You're not charmed.
Now tell me why I ought to trust you, I say to her and the roach. The ghost came, with Vulsibur, to take me to the Tower of Forgetting, urged me to go alone, led me right to where I was to be captured, and I still don't know why. Were either of you in on it with him?
We didn't know the ghost had betrayed us until it was too late,
the roach says. I nod. I saw the old forest entrance to the Court of Shadows.
The ghost activated some of our own explosives.
He dips his head toward the bomb.
Collapsed part of the castle, along with the lair of the Court of Shadows. Not to mention the old catacombs where Mab's bones lie,
Cardin says.
He's been planning this for a while. I was able to keep it from being worse, the bomb says. A few of us got out unscathed. Snapdragon as well, and spotted you climbing the hill of the palace. But many were hurt in the blast. The Slua, Niniel, got badly burned.
What about the ghost? I ask.
He's in the wind, the bomb says. Gone. We know not where.
I remind myself that so long as the bomb and the roach are okay, things could have been a lot worse.
Now that we're all on the same dreary page,
Cardin says,
we must discuss what to do next.
If Baelkin thinks he can get me into the masquerade, then let him bend his will toward that aim. I'll play along. I stop and turn to Cardin. Or I could just kill him.
The roach claps his hand on the back of my neck with a laugh.
You did good, kid. You know that? You came out of the sea even tougher than you went in.
I have to look down because I am surprised by how much I wanted to hear someone say that. When I glance back up, Cardin is watching me carefully. He looks stricken. I shake my head, to keep him from saying whatever he's thinking.
Baelkin is the ambassador of the Undersea,
he says instead, an echo of my own words to Dulcamera. I am grateful for a return to the subject.
He's protected by Orla, and she has Grimson, and a mighty desire to test me. If her ambassador was killed, she would be very angry.
Orla attacked the land already, I remind him. The only reason she hasn't declared outright war is that she's seeking every advantage. But she will. So let the first blow be ours. Cardin shakes his head. He wants to have you killed, I insist. Grimson has made that a condition of Baelkin getting the crown.
You should have the hands of the smith, the bomb says. Cut them off at the wrist so he can make no more trouble.
The roach nods.
I will find him tonight. The three of you have one solution to every problem. Murder. No key fits every lock.
Cardin gives us all a stern look, holding up a long-fingered hand with my stolen ruby ring still on one finger.
Someone tries to betray the High King? Murder. Someone gives you a harsh look? Murder. Someone disrespects you? Murder. Someone ruins your laundry? Murder. I find the more I listen, the more I am reminded that I have been awakened after very little sleep. I am going to send for some tea for myself and some food for Jude, who looks a bit pale.
Cardin stands and sends a servant for oatcakes, cheese, and two enormous pots of tea. But he does not allow anyone else into the room. He carries a large carved wood and silver tray from the door himself, setting it down on a low table. I am too hungry to resist making a sandwich from the cakes and the cheese. After I eat a second one and wash it down with 3 cups of tea, I do feel steadier.
The masquerade tomorrow,
Cardin says.
It is to honor Lord Roybin of the Court of Termites. He has come all this way to yell at me, so we ought to let him. If Baelkin's assassination attempt keeps him busy until after that, so much the better. Roach, if you can spirit away Grimson to somewhere he won't cause any trouble, that would be most helpful. It's time for him to choose sides and bend his knee to one of the players in this little game. But I do not want Baelkin dead.
The roach takes a sip of tea and raises one bushy brow. The bomb sighs audibly. Cardin turns to me.
Since you were taken, I've gone over all the history I could find on the relationship of the land and the sea. From when the first High Queen, Mab, summoned the Isles of Elfheim from the depths, our folk have occasionally skirmished. But it seems clear that should we fight in earnest, there will be no victor. You said that you thought Queen Orla was waiting for an advantage to declare war.
Instead, I think she is trying a new ruler. One she hopes she can trick or replace with another indebted to her. She thinks me young and feckless, and means to take my measure.
So what? I ask. Our choice is to endure her games, no matter how deadly, or engage in a war we cannot win? Cardin shakes his head and drinks another cup of tea.
We show her that I am no feckless High King.
And how do we do that? I ask.
With great difficulty,
he says.
Since I fear she is right.
Chapter 27. It would be a small thing to smuggle one of my own dresses out of my rooms, but I don't want Baelkin to guess I've been inside the palace. Instead, I head to the Mandrake Market on the tip of Innsmore to find something suitable for the masquerade. I've been to the Mandrake Market twice before, both times long past and accompanying Matic. It is exactly the sort of place that Orianna warned Taryn and me away from. Entirely too full of folk eager to make bargains. It's open only in the misty mornings, when most of Elfheim is asleep. But if I can't get a gown and a mask there, I will have to steal one out of a courtier's wardrobe. I walk through the stalls, a little queasy from the smell of oysters smoking on a bed of kelp, the scent reminding me forcefully of the undersea. I pass trays of spun sugar animals, little acorn cups filled with wine, enormous sculptures of horn, and a stall where a bent-backed woman takes a brush and draws charms on the soles of shoes. It takes some wandering, but I finally find a collection of sculpted leather masks. They are pinned to a wall and cunningly shaped like the faces of strange animals, or laughing goblins, or boorish mortals, painted gold and green and every other color imaginable. I find one that is of a human face, unsmiling. This one, I say to the shopkeeper. A tall woman with a hollow back. She gives me a dazzling smile.
Seneschal, she says, recognition lighting her eyes. Let it be my gift to you.
That's very kind, I say, a little desperately. All gifts come with a price, and I am already struggling to pay my debts. But I'd prefer, she winks,
and when the High King compliments your mask, you will let me make him one.
I nod, relieved that what she wants is straightforward. The woman takes the mask from me, laying it down on the table and pulling out a pot of paint from beneath a desk.
Let me make a little alteration.
What do you mean? She takes out a brush.
So she looks more like you.
And with a few swipes of the brush, the mask does bear my likeness. I stare at it and see Taryn. I will remember your kindness, I say, as she packs it up. Then I depart and look for the fluttering cloth that marks a dress shop. I find a lace maker instead, and get a little turned around in a maze of potion makers and tellers of fortunes. As I attempt to find my way back, I pass a stall occupied by a small fire. A hag sits on a little stool before it. She stirs the pot, and from it comes the scent of stewing vegetables. When she glances in my direction, I recognize her as Mother Merrow.
Come and sit by my fire, she says.
I hesitate. It doesn't do to be rude in fairy, where the highest laws are those of courtesy. But I am in a hurry. I am afraid that I
have some soup, she says,
picking up a bowl and shoving it toward me.
It is only that which is most wholesome.
Then why offer it to me? I ask. She gives a delighted laugh.
If you had not cost my daughter her dreams, I might well like you. Sit. Eat. Tell me, what have you come to the Mandrake Market for?
A dress, I say, moving to perch by the fire. I take the bowl, which is filled with an unappetizing thin brown liquid. Perhaps you could consider that your daughter might not have liked a princess of the sea for a rival. I spared her that, at least. She gives me an evaluating look.
She was spared you,
Moreover,
some might say that was a prize above price, I tell her. Mother Marrow gestures to the soup. And I, who can afford no more enemies, bring it to my lips. It tastes of a memory I cannot quite place. Warm afternoons and splashing in pools and kicking plastic toys across the brown grass of summer lawns. Tears spring to my eyes. I want to spill it out in the dirt. I want to drink it down to the dregs.
That'll fix you right up, she says, as I blink back everything I was feeling and glare at her. Now, about the dress. What would you give me for one?
I take off the pair of pearl earrings from the undersea. How about these? For the dress and the soup. They are worth more than the price of 10 dresses, but I do not want to engage in any more bargaining, especially with Mother Marrow. She takes them, sliding her teeth over the nacre, then tucking them away in a pocket.
Well enough.
Out of another pocket, she takes a walnut and holds it out to me. I raise my eyebrows.
Don't you trust me, girl? She asks.
Not as far as I can throw you, I return. And she lets out another cackle. Still, something is in the walnut. And it's probably some kind of gown. Because otherwise, she wouldn't be honoring the terms of the agreement. And I will not play the naive mortal for her, demanding to know how everything works. With that thought, I stand.
I don't much like you, she says, which is not an enormous surprise, although it stings. But I like the sea folk far less.
Thusly dismissed, I take the walnut and my mask and make the trek back to Innsmire and Hollow Hall. I look out at the waves all around us, the expanse of ocean in every direction, with its constant, restless, white-tipped waves. When I breathe, salt spray catches me in the back of my throat. And when I walk, I must avoid tide pools with little crabs in them. It seems hopeless to fight something so vast. It seems ridiculous to believe we can win. Balekin is sitting in a chair near the stairs when I come into Hollow Hall.
And where did you spend the night?
He asks. All insinuation. I go over to him and lift my new mask. Costuming. He nods, bored again.
You may ready yourself,
he says, waving vaguely to the stairs. I go up. I'm not sure which room he intends for me to use, but I go again to Cardin's. There, I bathe. Then I sit on the rug before the unlit grate and crack open the walnut. Out spills pale apricot muslin, frothing quantities of it. I shake the dress. It has an empire waist and wide gathered sleeves that start just above the elbow, so that my shoulders are bare. It hangs down to the floor in more gathered pleats. When I put it on, I realize the fabric is the perfect complement to my complexion, although nothing can make me look less starved. No matter how the dress flatters me, I can't get away from the feeling that my skin doesn't fit. Still, it will do well for the night. As I adjust it, however, I realize the dress has several cunningly hidden pockets. I transfer the poison to one. I transfer the smallest of my knives to another. Then I attempt to make myself presentable. I find a comb among Cardin's things and attempt to fix my hair. I have nothing to put it up with, so I wear it loose around my shoulders. I wash out my mouth. Then, tying the mask on, I head back to where Balekin waits. Up close, I'm likely to be recognized by those who know me well, but otherwise I think I will be able to pass unnoticed through the larger crowd. When he sees me, he has no visible reaction, but impatience. He stands.
You know what to do?
Sometimes lying is a real pleasure. I take the stoppered vial from my pocket. I was a spy for Prince Dane. I have been a part of the Court of Shadows. You can trust me to kill your brother. That brings a smile to his face.
Cardan was an ungrateful child to imprison me. He ought to have put me beside him. He ought to have made me seneschal. Really, he ought to have given me the crown.
I say nothing, thinking of the boy I saw in the crystal. The boy who still hoped he might be loved. Cardan's admission of who he has become since haunts me. If he thought I was bad, I would be worse. How well I know that feeling.
I will mourn my youngest brother,
Failkin says, seeming to cheer himself a bit at the thought.
I may not mourn the others, but I will have songs composed in his honor. He alone will be remembered.
I think of Dulcamera's exhortation to kill Prince Bailkin, that he was the one who ordered the attack on the Court of Termites. Maybe he was responsible for the ghost setting explosives in the Court of Shadows. I recall him under the sea, exultant in his power. I think of all that he's done, and all he intends to do, and am glad I am masked.
Come,
he says, and I follow him out the door. Only Locke would make the ridiculous choice of arranging a masquerade for a grave affair of state, such as hosting Lord Roybin after an attack on his lands. And yet, when I sweep into the Buddha on Bailkin's arm, such a thing appears underway. Goblins and Griggs, pixies and elves all cavort in endless intertwined circle dances. Honey wine flows freely from horns, and tables are stacked with ripe cherries, gooseberries, pomegranates, and plums. I walk from Bailkin toward the empty dais, scanning the crowd for Cardan, but he is nowhere to be seen. I catch sight of salt-white hair instead. I am partway to the convocation from the Court of Termites when I pass Locke. I swing toward him.
You tried to kill me.
He startles. Maybe he doesn't remember the way he limped on his wedding day, but surely he must have known I would see the earrings in Terran's ears. Perhaps since the consequences took so long in coming, he supposed they wouldn't come at all.
It wasn't supposed to be so serious,
he says, reaching for my hand, a ridiculous grin coming to his face.
I only wanted you to be afraid the way you'd frighten me.
I jerk my fingers from his grip. I have little time for you now, but I will make time for you anon. Terran, dressed in a gorgeous panniered ball gown all robin's egg blue, embroidered with delicate roses, and wearing a lacy mask over her eyes, sweeps up to us.
Make time for Locke? Whatever for?
He raises his brows, then throws an arm over his wife's shoulders.
Your twin is upset with me. She had a gift all planned out for you, but I was the one to present the gift in her stead.
That's accurate enough that it's hard to contradict him, especially given the suspicious way that Terran is looking at me.
What gift?
She wants to know. I ought to just tell her about the riders, about how I hid the fight in the forest from her because I didn't want her to be upset on her wedding day, about how I lost the earrings, about how I cut one of the riders down and threw a dagger at her husband. About how, whether or not he wanted me dead, he was certainly willing to let me die. But if I say all that, will she believe me? As I am trying to decide how to respond, Lord Roybin moves in front of us, looking down at me with his shining silver eyes. Locke bows. My sister sinks into a beautiful curtsy, and I copy her as best I can.
An honor, she says. I've heard many of your ballads.
Hardly mine,
he demurs,
and largely exaggerated. Though blood does bounce on ice, that line is very true.
My sister looks momentarily discomfited. Did you bring your consort?
Kay, yes. She's in plenty of those ballads as well, isn't she? No, I am afraid she didn't come this time. Our last journey to the High Court was not quite what I promised her it would be.
Dulcamera said she was badly hurt, but he is taking care to avoid saying so. Interesting care. Not a single lie, but a web of misdirection.
The coronation, Taryn says.
Yes,
he goes on.
Not quite the mini-break either of us envisioned.
Taryn smiles a little at that, and Lord Roybin turns toward me.
You will excuse Jude?
He asks Taryn.
We have something pressing to discuss.
Of course, she says, and Roybin escorts me away, toward one of the darker corners of the hall. Is she well? I ask. Kay?
She will live,
he says tersely.
Where is your High King?
I scan the hall again, my gaze going to the dais and the empty throne. I don't know, but he'll be here. Only last night, he expressed his regret over your losses and his desire to speak with you.
We both know who was behind this attack,
Roybin says.
Prince Baelkin blames me for throwing my weight and influence behind you and your princeling when you got him a crown.
I nod, glad of his calm.
You made me a promise,
he says.
Now it is time to determine if a mortal is truly as good as her word.
I will fix things, I vow. I will find a way to fix things. Lord Roybin's face is calm, but his silver eyes are not, and I am forced to remember that he murdered his way to his own throne.
I will speak to your High King, but if he cannot give me satisfaction, then I must call in my debt.
And with that, he departs in a swirl of his long cloak. Courtiers cover the floor, executing intricate steps, a circle dance that turns in on itself, splits into three, and reforms. I see Locke and Taryn out there, together, dancing. Taryn knows all the steps. I will have to do something about Locke eventually, but not tonight. Maddox sweeps into the room, Orianna on his arm. He is dressed in black and she in white. They look like chess pieces on opposite sides of the board. Behind them come Mikhail and Randolin. A quick scan of the room, and I spot Baefin speaking with a horned woman. It takes me a moment to recognize. When I do, it comes with a jolt. Lady Asha, Cardin's mother. I knew she was a courtier before. Saw it in the crystal globe on Eldred's desk. But now it is as though I am seeing her for the first time. She wears a high-skirted gown, so that her ankles show along with little shoes cunningly made to resemble leaves. Her whole dress is in shades of autumn, leaves and blossoms of moor cloth stitched over the length of it. The tips of her horns have been painted with copper, and she wears a copper circlet, which is not a crown, but reminiscent of one. Cardin said nothing to me about her, and yet somehow they must have effected a reconciliation. He must have pardoned her. As another courtier leads her out to the dance, I am uncomfortably aware that she is likely to acquire both power and influence quickly, and that she will do nothing good with either.
Where is the High King?
Neora asks. I didn't notice the Seelie representative until she was beside me, and I startle. How ought I to know? I demand. I wasn't even allowed inside the palace until today. It is just then that Cardin finally enters the room. Ahead of him are two members of his personal guard, who step away from him once they've escorted him safely to the Buddha. A moment later, Cardin falls. He sprawls across the floor in all his fantastic robes of state, then begins to laugh. He laughs and laughs, as though this is the most amazing trick he's ever performed. He's obviously drunk. Very, very drunk. My heart falls. When I look over at Nior, she is expressionless. Even Locke, staring over from the dance floor, looks discomfited. Meanwhile, Cardin gets up and snatches a lute from the hands of an amazed goblin musician. He leaps unsteadily onto a long banquet table. Strumming the strings, he begins a song so vulgar
that the entire court stops their dancing to listen and titter. Then, as one, they join in the madness. The courtiers of Faerie are not shy. They begin to dance again, now to the High King's song. I didn't even know he could play. When the song is over, he falls off the table, landing awkwardly on his side. His crown tilts forward so it's hanging over one of his eyes. His guards rush over to help him up off the floor, but he waves them away.
How's that for an introduction?
He demands of Lord Roybin, although they have in fact met before.
I am no dull monarch.
I look over at Baelkin, who is wearing a satisfied smirk. Lord Roybin's face is like stone, unreadable. My gaze goes to Matic, who watches Cardan with disgust as he fixes his crown. Grimly, Roybin goes through the motions of what he's come here to do.
Your Majesty, I have come to ask you to allow me vengeance for my people. We were attacked, and now we wish to respond.
I have seen many people unable to humble themselves, but Lord Roybin does it with great grace. And yet, with a look at Cardan, I know it won't matter.
They say you're a specialist in bloodshed. I suppose you want to show off your skills.
Cardan wags a finger in Roybin's direction. The Unseelie King grimaces at that. A part of him must want to show off immediately, but he makes no comment.
Yet that you must forego, Cardan says. I'm afraid you've come a long way for nothing. At least there's wine.
Lord Roybin turns his silvery gaze on me, and there's a threat in it. This is not going at all the way I hoped. Cardan waves his hand toward a table of refreshments. The skins of the fruit curl back from the flesh, and a few globes burst, spilling out seeds and startling nearby courtiers.
I've been practicing a skill of my own, he says with a laugh.
I go toward Cardan to try to intercede when Matic catches my hand. His lip curls.
Is this going according to your plan?
He demands under his breath.
Get him out of here.
I'll try, I say.
I have stood by long enough,
Matic says, his cat eyes staring into mine.
Get your puppet to abdicate the throne in favor of your brother, or face the consequences. I won't ask you again. It's now or never.
I pitch my voice low to match his. After barring me from the palace?
You were ill,
he returns. Working with you will always be working for you, I say. So, never.
You would really choose that over your own family,
he sneers, his gaze going to Cardan before cutting back to me. I wince, but no matter how right he is, he's also wrong. Whether you believe me or not, this is for my family, I tell him, and lay my hand on Cardan's shoulder, hoping I can guide him out of the room without anything else going wrong.
Oh ho,
he says.
My darling Seneschal, let us take a turn around the room.
He grabs me and pulls me toward the dance. He can barely stand. 3 times he stumbles, and 3 times I have to hold most of his weight to keep him upright. Cardan, I hiss. This is no meet behavior for the High King. He giggles at that. I think of how serious he was last night in his rooms, and how far he seems from that person. Cardan, I try again. You must not do this. I order you to pull yourself together. I command you to drink no more liquor, and to attempt sobriety.
Yes, my sweet villain, my darling god. I will be as sober as a stone carving, just as soon as I can.
And with that, he kisses me on the mouth. I feel a cacophony of things at once. I am furious with him. Furious and resigned that he is a failure as High King. Corrupt and fanciful and as weak as Orla could have hoped. Then there is the public nature of the kiss. Parading this before the court is shocking, too. He's never been willing to seem to want me in public. Perhaps he can take it back. But in this moment, it is known. But there is also a weakness in me. Because I dreamed of him kissing me for all my time in the undersea. And now, with his mouth on mine, I want to sink my nails into his back. His tongue brushes my lower lip, the taste heady and familiar. Wraithberry. He's not drunk. He's been poisoned. I pull back and look into his eyes. Those familiar eyes. Black, rimmed in gold. His pupils are blown wide.
Sweet Jude, you are my dearest punishment.
He dances away from me. And immediately falls to the ground again, laughing, arms flung wide as though he would embrace the whole room. I watch in astonished horror. Someone poisoned the High King, and he is going to laugh and dance himself to death in front of a court that will veer between delight and disgust. They will think him ridiculous as his heart stops. I try to concentrate. Antidotes. There must be one. Water, certainly to flush the system. Clay. The bomb would know more. I look around for her, but all I see is the dizzying array of courtiers. I turn to one of the guards instead. Get me a pail, a lot of blankets, 2 pitchers of water, and put them in my rooms, yes?
As you wish,
he says, turning to give orders to the other knights. I turn back to Cardin, who has, predictably, headed in the worst direction possible. He's walking straight toward the counselors Baithin and Randolin, where they stand with Lord Roybin and his knight, Dulcamera, doubtlessly trying to smooth the situation over. I can see the faces of the courtiers, the glitter of their eyes as they regard him with a kind of greedy scorn. They watch as he lifts a carafe of water, tipping it back to cascade over his laughing mouth till he chokes on it. Excuse us, I say, wrapping my arm through his. Dulcamera greets this with disdain.
We have come all this way to have an audience with the High King. Surely he means to stay longer than this.
He's been poisoned. The words are on my tongue when I hear Baelkin say to them instead.
I fear the High King is not himself. I believe he's been poisoned.
And then, too late, I understand the scheme.
You,
he says to me,
turn out your pockets. You are the only one here not bound by a vow.
Had I been truly glamored, I would have had to pull out the stoppered vial. And once the court saw it and found Wraithberry inside, any protest would come to nothing. Mortals are liars, after all. He's drunk, I say, and am gratified by Baelkin's shocked expression. However, you are unbound as well, Ambassador. Or shall I say, not bound to the land?
Have I drunk too much? Merely a cup of poison for my breakfast and another for my dinner,
Cardin says. I give him a look but say no more as I guide the stumbling High King across the floor.
Where are you taking him? Asks one of the guards. Your Majesty, do you wish to depart?
We all dance at Jude's command, he says, and laughs.
Of course he doesn't wish to go,
Baelkin says.
Attend to your other duty, Seneschal. And let me look after my brother. He has duties to perform tonight.
You will be sent for if you're needed, I tell him, trying to bluff through this. My heart speeds. I am not sure if anyone here would be on my side if it came to that.
Jude Duarte, you will leave the High King's side,
Baelkin says. At that tone, Cardin's focus narrows. I can see him straining to concentrate.
She will not,
he says. Since no one can gainsay him, even in this state, I am able to finally lead him out. I bear up the heavy weight of the High King as we move through the passageways of the palace.
Chapter 28. The High King's personal guard follows us at a distance. Questions run through my mind. How was he poisoned? Who actually put whatever he drank in his hand? When did it happen? Grabbing a servant in the hall, I send out runners for the bomb and, if they are unable to find her, an alchemist. You're going to be okay, I say.
You know,
he says, hanging on to me.
That ought to be reassuring, but when mortals say it, it doesn't mean the same thing as when the folk do, does it? For you, it's an appeal, a kind of hopeful magic. You say I will be well, because you fear I won't be.
For a moment, I don't speak. You're poisoned, I say finally. You know that, right? He doesn't startle.
Ugh,
he says.
Broken.
I say nothing. Just set him down before the fire in my rooms, his back against my couch. He looks odd there, his beautiful clothes a contrast to the plain rug, his face pale with a hectic flush in his cheeks. He reaches up and presses my hand to his face.
It's funny, isn't it? How I mocked you for your mortality, when you're certain to outlive me.
You're not going to die, I insist.
Oh, how many times have I wished that you couldn't lie. Never more than now.
He lolls to one side, and I grab one of the pitchers of water and pour a glassful. I bring it to his lips. Cardin, get down as much as you can. He doesn't reply, and seems about to fall asleep. No. I pat his cheek with increasing force until it's more of a smack. You've got to stay awake. His eyes open. His voice is muzzy.
I'll just sleep for a little while.
Unless you want to wind up like Severin of Fairfold, encased in glass for centuries, while mortals line up to take pictures with his body, you're going to stay awake. He shifts into a more upright sitting position.
Fine,
he says.
Talk to me.
I saw your mother tonight, I say. All dressed up. The time I saw her before that was in the Tower of Forgetting.
And you're wondering if I forgot her?
He says airily. And I am pleased that he's paying enough attention to deliver one of his typical quips. Glad you're up to mocking.
I hope it's the last thing about me to go. So tell me about my mother.
I try to think of something to say that isn't entirely negative. I go for carefully neutral. The first time I met her, I didn't know who she was. She wanted to trade me some information for getting her out of the tower. And she was afraid of you.
Good,
he says. My eyebrows go up. So how did she wind up a part of your court?
I suppose I have some fondness for her yet,
he admits. I pour him some more water, and he drinks it more slowly than I'd like. I refill the glass as soon as I can. There are so many questions I wish I could ask my mom, I admit.
What would you ask?
The words slur together, but he gets them out. Why she married Maddock, I say, pointing to the glass, which he obediently brings to his mouth. Whether she loved him, and why she left him, and whether she was happy in the human world. Whether she actually murdered someone and hid her body in the burnt remains of Maddox's original stronghold. He looks surprised.
I always forget that part of the story.
I decide a subject changes in order. Do you have questions like that for your father?
Why am I the way I am?
His tone makes it clear he's proposing something I might suggest he ask, but not really wondering about it.
There are no real answers, Jude.
Why was I cruel to folk? Why was I awful to you? Because I could be. Because I liked it. Because, for a moment, when I was at my worst, I felt powerful. And most of the time, I felt powerless. Despite being a prince and the son of the High King of Faerie.
That's an answer, I say.
Is it?
And then, after a moment,
you should go.
Why? I ask, annoyed. For one, this is my room. For another, I am trying to keep him alive. He looks at me solemnly.
Because I'm going to retch.
I grab for the bucket, and he takes it from me. His whole body convulsing with the force of vomiting. The contents of his stomach appear like matted leaves, and I shudder. I didn't know Wraithberry did that. There's a knock on the door, and I go to it. The bomb is there, out of breath. I let her in, and she moves past me, straight to Cardin. Here, she says, pulling out a little vial. It's clay. It may help draw out and contain the toxins. Cardin nods and takes it from her, swallowing the contents with a grimace.
It tastes like dirt.
It is dirt, she informs him. And there's something else. Two things, really. Grimson was already gone from his forge when we tried to capture him. We have to assume the worst. That he's with Orla. Also, I was given this. She takes a note from her pocket. It's from Baelkin. Cannily phrased. But breaks down to this. He's offering the antidote to you, Jude. If you will bring him the crown.
The crown.
Cardin opens his eyes, and I realize he must have closed them without my noticing. He wants you to take it to the gardens, near the roses, the bomb says. What happens if he doesn't get the antidote? I ask. The bomb puts the back of her hand against Cardin's cheek. He's the High King of Elfheim. He has the strength of the land to draw on, but he's very weak already. And I don't think he knows how to do it. Your Majesty? He looks at her with benevolent incomprehension.
Whatever do you mean? I just took a mouthful of the land at your behest.
I think about what she's saying, about what I know of the High King's powers. Surely you have noticed that since his reign began, the Isles are different. Storms come in faster. Colors are a bit more vivid. Smells are sharper. But all of that was done without trying. I'm certain he didn't notice the land altering itself to better suit him. Look at them all. Your subjects, he'd said to me at a revel months ago. A shame not a one knows who their true ruler is. If Cardin doesn't believe himself to be the true High King of Elfheim, if he doesn't allow himself to access his own power, it will be my fault. If Wraithberry kills him, it will be because of me. I'll get that antidote, I say. Cardin lifts the crown from his head and looks at it for a moment, as though somehow he cannot fathom how it came into his hand.
This can't pass to Oak if you lose it. Although I admit the succession gets tricky if I die.
I already told you, I say. You're not going to die. And I am not going to take that crown. I go in the back and change around the contents of my pockets. I tie on a cloak with a deep hood and a new mask. I am so furious that my hands shake. Wraithberry, which I was once invulnerable to, thanks to careful Mithridatism. If I had been able to keep up the doses, I could have perhaps tricked Baelkin as I once tricked Madoc. But after my imprisonment in the Undersea, I have one less advantage and far higher stakes. I have lost my immunity. I am as vulnerable to poison as Cardin is. You'll stay with him? I ask the bomb. And she nods.
No,
says Cardin.
She goes with you.
I shake my head. The bomb knows about potions. She knows about magic.
She can make sure you don't get worse. He ignores me and takes her hand.
Lilavir, as your king, I command you.
He says with great dignity for someone sitting on the floor, beside the bucket he's wretched in.
Go with Jude.
I turn to the bomb, but I see in her face that she won't disobey him. She's made her oath and even given him her name. He's her king. Damn you, I whisper to one, or maybe both of them. I vow that I will get the antidote swiftly, but that doesn't make it any easier for me to leave when I know the Wraithberry could yet stop his heart. His searing gaze follows us out the door, blown pupils, and crown still clenched in his hand. Baelkin is in the garden as he promised, near a blooming tree of silver-blue roses. When I get there, I note figures not too distant from where we stand, other courtiers going for midnight strolls. It means he cannot attack me, but neither can I attack him. At least not without others knowing about it.
You are a great disappointment, he says.
It's such a shock that I actually laugh. You mean because I wasn't glamored? Yes, I can see how that would be very sad for you. He glowers, but he doesn't even have Volsibur beside him now to threaten me. Perhaps being the ambassador of the Undersea makes him believe he's untouchable. All I can think about is that he poisoned Cardin. He tormented me. He pushed Orla to raid the land. I am shaking with anger, but trying to bite back that fury so I can get through what must be done.
Did you bring me the crown?
He asks. I've got it nearby, I lie. But before I hand it over, I want to see the antidote. He pulls a vial from his coat, nearly the twin of the one he gave me, which I take out of my pocket. They would have executed me if they'd found me with this poison, I say, shaking it. That's what you intended, wasn't it?
Someone may execute you yet, he says.
Here's what we're going to do. I take the stopper out of the bottle. I am going to drink the poison, and then you're going to give me the antidote. If it works on me, then I'll bring out the crown and trade it to you for the bottle. If not, then I guess I'll die. But the crown will be lost forever. Whether Cardin lives or dies, that crown is hidden well enough that you won't find it.
Grimson can forge me another,
Baelkin says. If that's true, then what are we here for? Baelkin grimaces. And I consider the possibility that the little smith isn't with Orla after all. Maybe he's disappeared after doing his best to set us at one another's throats.
You stole that crown from me, he says.
True enough, I admit. And I'll hand it over to you, but not for nothing.
I can't lie, mortal. If I say I will give you the antidote, I will do it. My word is enough.
I give him my best scowl. Everyone knows to beware when bargaining with the folk. You deceive with your every breath. If you truly have the antidote, what does it harm you to let me poison myself? I would think it would be a pleasure. He gives me a searching look. I imagine he's angry that I am not glamored. He must have had to scramble when I hustled Cardin out of the throne room. Was he always ready with the antidote? Did he think he could persuade Cardin to crown him? Was he arrogant enough to believe that the council wouldn't have stood in his way?
Very well,
he says.
One dose of antidote for you, and the rest for Cardin.
I unstopper the bottle he gave me and toss it back, drinking all the contents with a pronounced wince. I am angry, all over again, thinking of how sick I made myself taking tiny doses of poison, all for nothing.
Do you feel the Wraithberry working on your blood? It will work far faster on you than on one of us.
and you took such a large dose.
He watches me with such a fierce expression that I can tell he wishes he could leave me to die. If he could justify walking away right now, he would. For a moment, I think he might. Then he crosses toward me and unstoppers the bottle in his own hand.
"Please do not believe that I will put it in your hand," he says.
"Open your mouth like a little bird, and I will drop in your dose. Then you will give me the crown." I open my mouth obediently and let him pour the thick, bitter, honey-like stuff onto my tongue. I duck away from him, returning the distance between us, making sure I am closer to the entrance of the palace.
"Satisfied?"
he asks. I spit the antidote into the glass bottle, the one he gave me, the one that once contained wraithberry, but, until a few moments before, was filled only with water.
"What are you doing?"
he asks. I stopper it again and toss it through the air to the bomb, who catches it handily. Then she is gone, leaving him to gape at me.
"What have you done?"
he demands. "I tricked you," I tell him. "A bit of misdirection. I dumped out your poison and washed out the vial. As you keep forgetting, I grew up here, and so am also dangerous to bargain with. And, as you see, I can lie. And, like you reminded me so long ago, I am short on time." He draws the sword at his side. It's a thin, long blade. I don't think it's the one he used to fight Cardin in his tower room, but it might be. "We're in public," I remind him, "and I am still the High King's Seneschal." He looks around, taking in the sight of the other courtiers nearby.
"Leave us!"
he shouts at them, a thing it did not occur to me that anyone could do. But he is used to being a prince. He is used to being obeyed. And indeed, the courtiers seem to melt into the shadows, clearing the room for the sort of duel we definitely ought not to have. I slip my hand into my pocket, touching the hilt of a knife. The range on it is nothing like a sword. As Matic explained more than once, a sword is a weapon of war. A dagger is a weapon of murder. I'd rather have the knife than be unarmed. But more than anything, I wish I had Nightfell. "Are you suggesting a duel?" I ask. "I am sure you wouldn't want to bring dishonor to your name with me so outmatched in weaponry."
"You expect me to believe you have any honor?"
he asks. Which is, unfortunately, a fair point.
"You are a coward. A coward like the man who raised you."
He takes a step toward me, ready to cut me down whether I have a weapon or not. "Matic?" I draw my knife. It's not small, but it's still less than half the length of the blade he is leveling at me.
"It was Matic's plan that we should strike during the coronation. It was his plan that once Dane was out of the way, Eldred would see clear to put the crown on my head. It was all his plan. But he stayed Grand General, and I went to the Tower of Forgetting. And did he lift a finger to help me? He did not. He bent his head to my brother, whom he despises. And you're just like him, willing to beg and grovel and lower yourself to anyone if it gets you power."
I doubt putting Baelkin on the throne was ever part of Matic's true plan, whatever he allowed Baelkin to believe. But that doesn't make the word sting any less. I have spent a lifetime making myself small in the hopes I could find an acceptable place in Elfheim. And then, when I pulled off the biggest, grandest coup imaginable, I had to hide my abilities more than ever. "No," I say, "that's not true." He looks surprised. Even in the Tower of Forgetting, when he was a prisoner, I still let Vulsalbur strike me. In the Undersea, I pretended to have no dignity at all. Why should he think I see myself any differently than he sees me?
You are the one who bent your head to Orla, instead of to your own brother, I say. You're the coward and a traitor, a murderer of your own kin. But worse than all that, you're a fool. He bares his teeth as he advances on me, and I, who have been pretending to subservience, remember my most troublesome talent, pissing off the folk.
Go ahead, he says. Run, like the coward you are.
I take a step back. Kill Prince Baelkin. I think of Dulcamera's words, but I don't hear her voice. I hear my own, rough with seawater, terrified and cold and alone. Maddox's words of long ago come back to me. What is sparring but a game of strategy played at speed? The point of a fight is not to have a good fight. It's to win. I am at a disadvantage against a sword. A bad disadvantage. And I am still weak from my imprisonment in the undersea. Baelkin can hang back and take his time, while I can't get past the blade. He will take me apart slowly, cut by cut. My best bet is closing the distance fast. I need to get inside his guard, and I don't have the luxury of taking his measure before I do it. I'm going to have to rush him. I have one shot to get this right. My heart thunders in my ears. He lunges toward me, and I slam my knife against the base of his sword with my right hand, then grab his forearm with my left, twisting as though to disarm him. He pulls against my grip. I drive the knife toward his neck. Hold, Baelkin shouts. Aye, sir! Arterial blood sprays my arm, sprays the grass. It glistens on my knife. Baelkin slumps over, sprawling on the ground. It all happens so fast. It happens too fast. I want to have some reaction. I want to tremble or feel nauseated. I want to be the person who begins to weep. I want to be anyone but the person I am, who looks around to be sure no one saw, who wipes off my knife in the dirt, wipes off my hand on his clothes, and gets out of there before the guards come. You're a good little murderer, Dulcamera said. When I look back, Baelkin's eyes are still open, staring at nothing. Carden is sitting on the couch. The bucket is gone, and so is the bomb. He looks at me with a lazy smile.
Your dress. You put it back on.
I look at him in confusion. The consequences of what I've just done, including having to tell Carden, are hard to think past. But the dress I am wearing is the one I wore before, the one I got from Mother Marrow's walnut. There's blood on one sleeve of it now, but it is otherwise the same. Did something happen? I ask again.
I don't know,
he asks, puzzled.
Did it? I granted the boon you wanted. Is your father safe?
Boon? My father? Maddox, of course. Maddox threatened me. Maddox was disgusted by Carden. But what has he done? And what has it to do with dresses? Carden, I say, trying to be as calm as I can. I go over to the sofa and sit down. It's not a small couch, but his long legs are on it, blanketed and propped up on pillows. No matter how far from him I sit, it feels too close. You've got to tell me what happened. I haven't been here for the last hour. His expression grows troubled.
The bomb came back with the antidote, he says. She said you'd be right behind her. I was still so dizzy. And then a guard came, saying that there was an emergency. She went to see. And then you came in, just like she said you would. You said you had a plan.
He looks at me,
as though waiting for me to jump in and tell the rest of the story, the part I remember. But, of course, I don't. After a moment, he closes his eyes and shakes his head.
Taryn.
I don't understand, I say, because I don't want to understand.
Your plan was that your father was going to take half the army. But for him to function independently, he needed to be freed of his vows to the crown. You had on one of your doublets, the ones you always wear, and these odd earrings, moon and a star.
He shakes his head.
A cold chill goes through me.
As children in the mortal world, Taryn and I would switch places to play tricks on our mother. Even in fairy, we would sometimes pretend to be each other to see what we could get away with. Would a lecturer be able to tell the difference? Could Oriana? Matic? Oak? What about the great and mighty Prince Cardin? But how did she make you agree? I demand. She has no power. She could pretend to be me, but she couldn't force you. He puts his head in his long-fingered hands.
She didn't have to command me, Jude. She didn't have to use any magic. I trust you. I trusted you.
And I trusted Taryn. While I was murdering Baelkin, while Cardin was poisoned and disoriented, Matic made his move against the crown. Against me. And he did it with his daughter Taryn by his side.
Chapter 29. The High King is restored to his own chamber so he may rest. I feed my blood-stained dress to the fire, put on a robe, and plan. If none of the courtiers saw my face before Baelkin sent them away, then wrapped in my cloak, I might not have been identified. And, of course, I can lie. But the question of how to avoid blame for the murder of the Underseas ambassador pales beside the question of what to do about Matic. With half the army gone along with the general, if Orla decides to strike, I have no idea how to repel her. Cardin will have to choose another grand general, and quickly. And he will have to inform the lower courts of Matic's defection, to make sure it is known he doesn't speak with the voice of the High King. There must be a way to drive Matic back to the High Court. He is proud, but practical. Perhaps the answer lies in something to do with Oak. Perhaps it means I ought to make my hopes for Oak's rule less opaque. I am thinking over all this when a knock comes to my door. Outside, a messenger, a lilac-skinned girl in royal livery.
The High King requires your presence. I am to conduct you to his chambers.
I take an unsteady breath. No one else might have seen me, but Cardin cannot fail to guess. He knows whom I went to meet, and how late I returned from that meeting. He saw the blood on my sleeve.
You command the High King, not the other way around, I remind myself.
But the reminder feels hollow. Let me change, I say.
The messenger shakes her head. The king made it clear I was to ask you to come at once.
When I get to the royal chambers, I find Cardin alone, dressed simply, sitting in a throne-like chair. He looks wan, and his eyes still shine a bit too much, as though maybe poison lingers in his blood.
Please,
he says.
Sit.
Warily, I do.
Once, you had a proposal for me,
he says.
Now, I have one for you. Give me back my will. Give me back my freedom.
I suck in a breath. I'm surprised, although I guess I shouldn't be. No one wants to be under the control of another person, although the balance of power between us, in my view, has careened back and forth, despite his vow. My having command of him has felt like balancing a knife on its point, nearly impossible, and probably dangerous. Still, to give it up would mean giving up any semblance of power. It would be giving up everything. You know I won't do that. He doesn't seem particularly put off by my refusal.
Hear me out. What you want from me is obedience, for longer than a year and a day. More than half your time is gone. Are you ready to put Oak on the throne?
I don't speak for a moment, hoping he might think his question was rhetorical. When it becomes clear that's not the case, I shake my head.
And so you thought to extend my vow. Just how are you imagining doing that?
Again, I have no answer. Certainly no good one. It's his turn to smile.
You thought I had nothing to bargain with.
Underestimating him is a problem I've had before, and I fear I will have again. What bargain is possible, I ask, when what I want is for you to make the vow again, for at least another year, if not a decade, and what you want is for me to rescind the vow entirely.
Your father and sister tricked me,
Cardin says.
If Terran had given me a command, I would have known it wasn't you. But I was sick and tired and didn't want to refuse you. I didn't even ask why, Jude. I wanted to show you that you could trust me, that you didn't need to give me orders for me to do things. I wanted to show you that I believed you'd thought it all through. But that's no way to rule. And it's not really even trust, when someone can order you to do it anyway. Fairy suffered with us at each other's throats. You attempted to make me do what you thought needed to be done. And if we disagreed, we could do nothing but manipulate each other. That wasn't working. But simply giving in is no solution. We cannot continue like this. Tonight is proof of that. I need to make my own decisions.
You said you didn't mind so much, listening to my orders. It's a paltry attempt at humor. And he doesn't smile. Instead, he looks away, as though he can't quite meet my eyes.
All the more reason not to allow myself that luxury. You made me the High King, Jude. Let me be the High King.
I fold my arms protectively over my chest. And what will I be? Your servant? I hate that he's making sense. Because there is no way I can give him what he's asking. I can't step aside. Not with Matic out there. Not with so many threats. And yet, I cannot help recalling what the bomb said about Cardin's not knowing how to invoke his connection to the land. Or what the Roach said about Cardin's thinking of himself as a spy, pretending to be a monarch.
Marry me,
he says.
Become the queen of Elfheim.
I feel a kind of cold shock come over me, as though someone has told a particularly cruel joke. With me, its target. As though someone looked into my heart and saw the most ridiculous, most childish desire there and used it against me. But you can't.
I can,
he says.
Kings and queens don't often marry for something other than a political alliance, true. But consider this a version of that. And were you queen, you wouldn't need my obedience. You could issue all your own orders, and I would be free.
I can't help thinking of how mere months ago I fought for a place in the court, hoping desperately for knighthood, and didn't even get that. The irony that it's Cardin, who insisted that I didn't belong in Faerie at all, offering me this, makes it all the more shocking. He goes on.
Moreover, it's not as though we'd be married forever. Marriages between kings and queens must last as long as they rule. But in our case,
That's not so long. Only until Oak is old enough to rule. Assuming that's what he wants. You could have everything you want at the price of merely releasing me from my vow of obedience. My heart is pounding so hard that I fear it will stutter to a stop.
You're serious, I manage.
Of course I am. In earnest as well.
I look for the trick, because this must be one of those fairy bargains that sound like one thing, but turn out to be something very different. So let me guess. You want me to release you from your vow for your promise to marry me, but then the marriage will take place in the month of Never, when the moon rises in the west and the tides flow backward. He shakes his head, laughing.
If you agree, I will marry you tonight,
he says.
Now, even. Right here. We exchange vows, and it is done. This is no mortal marriage, to require being presided over and witnessed. I cannot lie. I cannot deny you.
It's not long until your vow is up, I say, because the idea of taking what he's offering, the idea that I could not only be part of the court, but the head of it, is so tempting that it's hard not to just agree, no matter the consequences. Surely the idea of a few more months tied to me can't be such a hardship that you'd like to tie yourself to me for years.
As I said before, a lot can happen in a year and a day. Much has happened in half that time.
We sit silently for a moment as I try to think. For the last 7 months, the question of what would happen after a year and a day has haunted me. This is a solution, but it doesn't feel at all practical. It's the stuff of absurd daydream, imagined while dozing in a mossy glen. Too embarrassing to even confess to my sisters. Mortal girls, do not become queens of fairyland. I imagine what it would be like to have my own crown, my own power. Maybe I wouldn't have to be afraid to love him. Maybe it would be okay. Maybe I wouldn't have to be scared of all the things I've been scared of my whole life, of being diminished and weak and lesser. Maybe I would become a little bit magic. Yes, I say, but my voice fails me. It comes out all breath. Yes. He leans forward in the chair, eyebrows raised, but he doesn't wear his usual arrogant mien. I cannot read his expression.
To what are you agreeing?
Okay, I say. I'll do it. I'll marry you. He gives me a wicked grin.
I had no idea it would be such a sacrifice.
Frustrated, I flop over on the couch. That's not what I mean.
Marriage to the High King of Elfheim is largely thought to be a prize, an honor of which few are worthy.
I suppose his sincerity could last, but only so long. I roll my eyes, grateful that he's acting like himself again, so I can better pretend not to be overawed by what's about to happen. So what do we do? I think of Taryn's wedding, and the part of the ceremony we did not witness. I think of my mother's wedding, too, the vows she must have made to Matic, and abruptly a shiver goes through me that I hope has nothing to do with premonition.
It's simple,
he says, moving to the edge of the chair.
We pledge our troth. I'll go first, unless you wish to wait. Perhaps you imagined something more romantic?
No, I say quickly, unwilling to admit to imagining anything to do with marriage at all. He slides my ruby ring off his finger.
I, Cardan, son of Eldred, High King of Elfheim, take you, Jude Duarte, mortal ward of Matic, to be my bride and my queen. Let us be wed until we wish for it to be otherwise, and the crown has passed from our hands.
As he speaks, I begin to tremble with something between hope and fear. The words he's saying are so momentous that they're surreal, especially here, in Eldred's own rooms. Time seems to stretch out. Above us, the branches begin to bud, as though the land itself heard the words he spoke. Catching my hand, he slides the ring on. The exchange of rings is not a fairy ritual, and I am surprised by it.
Your turn,
he says into the silence. He gives me a grin.
I'm trusting you to keep your word and release me from my bond of obedience after this.
I smile back, which maybe makes up for the way that I froze after he finished speaking. I still can't quite believe this is happening. My hand tightens on his as I speak. I, Jude Duarte, take Cardan, High King of Elfheim, to be my husband. Let us be wed until we don't want to be, and the crown has passed from our hands. He kisses the scar of my palm. I still have his brother's blood under my fingernails. I don't have a ring for him. Above us, the buds are blooming. The whole room smells of flowers. Drawing back, I speak again, pushing away all thoughts of Baelkin, of the future in which I am going to have to tell him what I've done. Cardan, son of Eldred, High King of Elfheim, I forsake any command over you. You are free of your vow of obedience, for now and for always. He lets out a breath and stands a bit unsteadily. I can't quite wrap my head around the idea that I am. I can't even think the words. Too much has happened tonight. You look as if you've barely rested. I rise to be sure that if he falls over, I can grab for him before he hits the floor. Although I am not so sure of myself, either.
I will lie down,
he says, letting me guide him toward his enormous bed. Once there, he does not let go of my hand.
If you lie with me.
With no reason to object, I do. The sense of unreality heightening. As I stretch out on the elaborately embroidered comforter, I realize that I have found something far more blasphemous than spreading out on the bed of the High King. Far more blasphemous than sneaking Cardan's signet onto my finger, or even sitting on the throne itself. I have become the Queen of Faerie. We trade kisses in the darkness, blurred by exhaustion. I don't expect to sleep, but I do. My limbs tangled with his. The first, restful sleep I've had since my return from the undersea. When I am awakened, it is to a banging on the door. Cardan is already up, playing with the vial of clay the balm brought, tossing it from hand to hand. He's still dressed, his rumpled aspect giving him only an air of dissipation. I pull my robe more tightly around me. I am embarrassed to be so obviously sharing his bed.
Your Majesty,
says the messenger, a knight.
Your brother is dead. There was a duel, from what we've been able to determine.
Cardan says.
And the Queen of the Undersea.
The knight's voice trembles.
She's here, demanding justice for her ambassador.
I just bet she is.
Cardan's voice is dry, clipped.
Well, we can hardly keep her waiting. You, what's your name?
The knight hesitates.
Rannoch, Your Majesty.
Sir Rannoch, assemble a group of knights to escort me to the water. Wait in the courtyard.
But the general,
he begins,
is not here right now.
Cardan finishes for him.
I will do it,
the knight says. I hear the door close, and Cardan rounds the corner, expression haughty.
Well, wife,
he says to me, a chill in his voice.
It seems you have kept at least one secret from your dowry. Come, we must dress for our first audience together.
My heart drops, but there is no time to explain, and no good explanation either. I am left to rush through the halls in my robe. Back in my rooms, I call for my sword and throw on my velvets, all the while wondering what it will mean to have this newfound status, and what Cardin will do now that he is unchecked. Chapter 30. Orla waits for us in a choppy ocean, accompanied by her daughter, and a pod of knights mounted on seals and sharks and all manner of sharp-toothed sea creatures. She herself sits on an orca and is dressed as though ready for battle. Her skin is covered in shiny silvery scales that seem both to be metallic and to have grown from her skin. A helmet of bone and teeth hides her hair. Nikasia is beside her on a shark. She has no tail today, her long legs covered in armor of shell. All along the edge of the beach are clumps of kelp, washed up as though from a storm. I think I see other things out in the water. The back of a large creature swimming just below the waves. The hair of drowned mortals, blowing like seagrass. The undersea's forces are larger than they seem at first glance.
Where is my ambassador?
Orla demands.
Where is your brother?
Cardin is seated on his gray steed, in black clothes and a cloak of scarlet. Beside him are 24 mounted knights, and both Mikael and Nior. On the ride over, they tried to determine what Cardin had planned, but he has kept his own counsel from them, and more troublingly, from me. Since hearing of the death of Baelkin, he's said little and avoided looking in my direction. My stomach churns with anxiety. He looks at Orla with a coldness that I know from experience comes from either fury or fear. In this case, possibly both.
As you well know, he's dead.
It was your responsibility to keep him safe, she says.
Was it?
Cardin asks, with exaggerated astonishment, touching his hand to his breast.
I thought my obligation was not to move against him, not to keep him from the consequences of his own risk-taking. He had a little duel, from what I hear. Dueling, as I am sure you know, is dangerous, but I neither murdered him, nor did I encourage it. In fact, I quite discouraged it.
I attempt to not let anything I am feeling show on my face. Orla leans forward, as though she senses blood in the water.
You ought not to allow such disobedience.
Cardin shrugs nonchalantly.
Perhaps.
Mikael shifts on his horse. He's clearly uncomfortable with the way Cardin is speaking. Carelessly. As though they are merely having a friendly conversation, and Orla hasn't come to chisel away his power, to weaken his rule. And if she knew Matic was gone, she might attack outright. Looking at her, looking at Nikasia's sneer and the Selkies and Merfolk's strange wet eyes, I feel powerless. I have given up command of Cardin, and for it, I have his vow of marriage. But without anyone's knowing, it seems less and less as though it ever happened.
I am here to demand justice. Baelkin was my ambassador. And if you don't consider him to be under your protection, I do consider him to be under mine. You must give his murderer to the sea, where she will find no forgiveness. Give us your seneschal, Jude Duarte.
For a moment, I feel as though I can't breathe. It's as though I am drowning again. Cardin's eyebrows go up. His voice stays light.
But she's only just returned from the sea.
So you don't dispute her crime? Asks Orla.
Why should I?
Asks Cardin,
If she's the one with whom he dueled, I am certain she would win. My brother supposed himself expert with the sword. A great exaggeration of abilities. But she's mine to punish. Or not, as I see fit.
I hate hearing myself spoken of as though I am not right there when I have his pledge of troth. But his queen killing an ambassador does seem like a worse political problem. Orla's gaze doesn't go to me. I doubt very much she cares about anything but that Cardin gave up a lot for my return. And by threatening me, she believes she can get more. King of the land, I am not here to fight your sharp tongue. My blood is cold, and I prefer blades. Once, I considered you as a partner for my daughter, the most precious thing in the sea. She would have brokered a true peace between us. Cardin looks at Nikasia, and although Orla leaves him an opening, for a long moment, he does not speak. And when he does, he only says,
"Like you, I am not skilled at forgiveness."
Something in Queen Orla's manner changes.
"If it's war you want, you would be unwise to declare it on an island."
Around her, waves grow more violent, their white caps of froth larger. Whirlpools coalesce just off the edge of the land. Small ones, deepening, only to spin themselves out as new ones form.
"War?"
He peers at her as though she said something particularly puzzling, and it vexes him.
"Do you mean for me to really believe you want to fight? Are you challenging me to a duel?"
He's obviously baiting her, but I cannot imagine to what benefit.
"And if I was," she asks, "what then, boy?"
The smile that curves his lip is voluptuous.
"Beneath every bit of your sea is land. Seething, volcanic land. Go against me, and I will show you what this boy will do, my lady."
He stretches out his hand, and something seems to rise to the top of the water around us, like a pale scrum. Sand. Floating sand. Then, all around the court of the undersea, water begins to churn. I stare at him, hoping to catch his eye. But he is concentrating. Whatever magic he is doing, this is what Baefin meant when he said the High King was tied to the land, was the beating heart and the star upon whom Elfheim's future was written. This is power, and to see Cardin wield it is to understand just how inhuman he is, how transformed, how far outside my control he's moved.
"Stop!"
Orla shouts, as the churning turns to boiling. A stretch of ocean bubbles and seethes as the folk of the undersea scream and scatter, swimming out of range. Several seals come up on the black rocks near the land, calling to one another in their language. Nikasia's shark is spun sideways, and she plunges into the water. Steam billows up from the waves, blowing hot. A huge white cloud rolls across my vision. When it clears, I can see that new earth is coalescing from the depths, hot stone cooling as we watch. With Nikasia kneeling on the growing isle, her expression half amazement and half terror.
"Cardin?" she calls.
One corner of his mouth is turned up in a little smile, but his gaze is unfocused. He believed that he needed to convince Orla that he wasn't feckless. Now I see he's come up with a plan to do that, just as he came up with a plan to throw off the yoke of my control. During my month in the undersea, he changed.
He began scheming schemes, and he has become disturbingly effective at them. I am thinking of that as I watch grass grow between Nikasia's toes, and wildflowers spring up all along the gently rising hills, as I notice the trees and brambles sprout, and as the trunk of a tree begins to form around Nikasia's body.
Cardin!
She screams, as bark wraps around her, closing over her waist.
What have you done?
Orla cries, as the bark moves higher, as branches unfold, budding with leaves and fragrant blossoms. Petals blow out onto the waves.
Will you flood the land now?
Cardin asks Orla, with perfect calm, as though he didn't just cause a fourth island to rise from the sea.
Send salt water to corrupt the roots of our trees and make our streams and lakes brackish? Will you drown our berries and send your merfolk to slit our throats and steal our roses? Will you do it if it means your daughter will suffer the same? Come, I dare you.
Release Nikasia, says Orla, defeat heavy in her voice.
I am the High King of Elfheim,
Cardin reminds her,
and I mislike being given orders. You attacked the land. You stole my seneschal and freed my brother, who was imprisoned for the murder of our father, Eldred, with whom you had an alliance. Once, we respected each other's territory. I have allowed you too much disrespect, and you have overplayed your hand. Now, Queen of the Undersea, we will have a truce, as you had with Eldred, as you had with Mab. We will have a truce, or we will have a war. And if we fight, I will be unsparing. Nothing and no one you love will be safe.
Orla pauses, and I suck in my breath, not at all sure what will come next.
Very well, High King. Let us have an alliance. Give me my daughter, and we will go.
I exhale. He was wise to push her, even though it was terrifying. After all, once she found out about Matic, she might press her advantage. Better to bring this moment to its crisis. And it worked. I look down to hide my smile.
Let Nikasia stay here and be your ambassador in Balekin's stead,
Cardin says.
She has grown up on these islands, and many who love her are here.
That wipes the smile off my face. On the new island, the bark is pulling away from Nikasia's skin. I wonder what he's playing at, bringing her back to Elfheim. With her will inevitably come trouble. And yet, maybe it's the sort of trouble he wants.
If she wishes to stay, she may. Are you satisfied?
Orla asks. Cardin inclines his head.
I am. I will not be led by the sea, no matter how great its queen. As the High King, I must lead. But I must also be just.
Here he pauses, and then turns to me.
And today, I will dispense justice. Jude Duarte, do you deny you murdered Prince Balekin, ambassador of the Undersea, and brother to the High King?
I am not sure what he wants me to say. Would it help to deny it? If so, surely he would not put it to me in such a way. A way that makes it clear he believes I did kill Balekin. Cardin has had a plan all along. All I can do is trust that he has a plan now.
I do not deny that we had a duel, and that I won it, I say, my voice coming out more uncertain than I'd like. All the eyes of the folk are on me, and for a moment, as I look out at their pitiless faces,
I feel Maddox's absence keenly. Orla's smile is full of sharp teeth.
Hear my judgment,
Cardin says, authority ringing in his voice.
I exile Jude Duarte to the mortal world. Until and unless she is pardoned by the crown, let her not step 1 foot in Faerie, or forfeit her life.
I gasp. But you can't do that. He looks at me for a long moment, but his gaze is mild, as though he's expecting me to be fine with exile, as though I am nothing more than one of his petitioners, as though I am nothing at all.
Of course I can,
he replies.
But I am the Queen of Faerie, I shout.
And for a moment, there is silence. Then everyone around me begins to laugh. I can feel my cheeks heat.
Tears of frustration and fury prick my eyes as, a beat too late, Cardin laughs with them. At that moment, knights clap their hands on my wrists. Sir Rannoch pulls me down from the horse. For a mad moment, I consider fighting him, as though 2 dozen knights aren't around us.
Deny it, then, I yell.
Deny me!
He cannot, of course. So he does not. Our eyes meet, and the odd smile on his face is clearly meant for me. I remember what it was to hate him with the whole of my heart, but I've remembered too late.
Come with me, my lady,
Sir Rannoch says, and there is nothing I can do but go. Still, I cannot resist looking back. When I do, Cardin is taking the first step onto the new island. He looks every bit the ruler his father was, every bit the monster his brother wanted to become. Crow black hair, blown back from his face, scarlet cape swirling around him, eyes reflecting the flat gray emptiness of the sky.
If Innsweel is the Isle of Woe, Innsmire the Isle of Might, and Innsmore the Isle of Stone,
he says, his voice carrying across the newly formed land,
then let this be Innsir, Isle of Ash.
Epilogue. I lie on the couch in front of the television. In front of me, a plate of microwaved fish sticks grows cold. On the screen, a cartoon ice skater is sulking. He's not a very good skater, I think. Or maybe he's a great skater. I keep forgetting to read the subtitles. It's hard to concentrate on pretty much anything these days. Vivi comes into the room and flops down on the couch.
Heather won't text me back, she says.
I turned up on Vivi's doorstep a week before, exhausted, my eyes red with weeping. Rannoch and his coterie had carried me across the sky on one of their horses and dumped me on a random street in a random town. I'd walked and walked until I had blisters on my feet, and I began to doubt my ability to navigate by the stars. Finally, I stumbled into a gas station with a taxi refueling and was startled to remember taxis existed. By then, I didn't care that I had no money with me and that Vivi was probably going to pay him with a handful of glamoured leaves. But I didn't expect to arrive and find Heather gone. When she and Vivi came back from Faerie, I guess she had a lot of questions. And then she'd had more questions. And finally, Vivi admitted to glamoring her. That's when everything totally unraveled. Vivi removed the glamour, and Heather got her memories back. Heather moved out. She's sleeping at her parents' house, so Vivi keeps hoping she might still come back. Some of her stuff is here. Clothes, her drafting table,
a set of unused oil paints. She'll text you when she's ready, I say, although I am not sure I believe it. She's just trying to get her head straight. Just because I am bitter about romance doesn't mean everyone else needs to be. For a while, we just sit on the couch together, watching the cartoon skater fail to land jumps and fall in helpless and probably unrequited love with his coach. Soon, Oak will come home from school, and we will pretend that things are normal. I will take him into the wooded part of the apartment complex and drill him on the sword. He doesn't mind, but to him it's only messing around, and I don't have the heart to scare him into seeing swordplay differently. Vivi takes a fish stick off my plate and dredges it through the ketchup.
How long are you going to keep sulking?
You were exhausted from being locked up in the undersea. You were off your game. He got one over on you. It happens. Whatever, I say, as she eats my food. If you hadn't gotten captured, you would have mopped the floor with him. I'm not even sure what that means, but it's nice to hear. She turns to me with her cat eyes, eyes just like her father's.
I wanted you to come to the mortal world.
Now you're here.
Maybe you'll love it. Give it a chance.
I nod noncommittally.
Then if you don't love it, she says, lifting an eyebrow, you can always join Matic.
I can't, I say. He tried and tried to recruit me, but I kept turning him down. That ship sailed. She shrugs.
He wouldn't... Okay, he would care. He'd make you grovel a lot. And he'd bring it up awkwardly in war councils for the next couple of decades. But he'd take you.
I give her a stern look. And what? Work to put Oak on the throne? After everything we've done to keep him safe?
Work to hurt Cardin,
Vivi says, with a fierce light in her eyes. She has never been particularly forgiving. Right now, I am glad of it. How, I say, but the strategic part of my brain is grinding slowly back into action. Grimson is still in play. If he could make a crown for Baelkin, what could he do for me?
I don't know, but don't worry about it yet, Vivi says, getting up. Revenge is sweet, but ice cream is sweeter.
She goes to the freezer and removes a tub of mint chocolate chip. She brings that and two spoons back to the sofa.
For now, accept this delight, unworthy though it is, for the queen of fairy in exile.
I know she doesn't mean to mock me, but the title stings anyway. I pick up my spoon. You must be strong enough to strike and strike and strike again without tiring. The first lesson is to make yourself that strong. We eat, bathed in the flickering light of the screen. Vivi's phone is silent on the coffee table. My mind is whirling.
We hope you have enjoyed listening to The Wicked King, written by Holly Black and read by Caitlin Kelly. The Wicked King is published by Hot Key Books, an imprint of Bonnier Zafra Limited. Text copyright 2019 by Holly Black. Audio production copyright 2019 by Ashet Audio. All rights reserved. Thank you for choosing A Hot Key Book. If you want to know more about our authors and what we publish, you can find us online at www.hotkeybooks.com.